This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rusland, today we have BFM's Mr. Tech, I call him that, Matt Armitage.
Hey, Cam, how are you?
I'm great. And you?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm here to spread some Christmas cheer.
Oh, yo, you're right. You always bring us down. Anyway, and also we have the return of...
remember my name.
Yep. No, I know your name. I just how to describe you. I mean, you're an actor. You're a media professional. And you are...
An uncle.
And you are...
Sarani.
That's what I was going to say. Mr. Sarani himself. Vernon Adrian Among.
Thank you.
And our three topics this week are... Topic number one will be Christmas songs. Topic number two... is the future of Facebook. And finally, topic number three will be the Christmas pantomime. Mm-hmm. So, Matt, it's that time of year. Christmas songs.
It is that time of year. I'm probably one of the only people who likes walking into malls and hearing the cheesy songs that are played over the intercom. I know it drives a lot of people mad, but it always makes me feel like Christmas, even when they start in October. I get that kind of good feeling. And I've always been, as much as I am... portrayed as the Grinch of Christmas, I've always been a huge fan of Christmas songs, and
I must say I like the elf outfit you're in.
Yes, it's fantastic. Although the headphones and the ears are a little bit of a hard fit, but I'm very uncritical when it comes to Christmas songs. It's one of those kind of blind spots in my musical armory. I mean, I used to do a music show with. Producer Daryl here, and we try and be as cool as possible in the songs that we chose. Yeah. But when it comes to Christmas songs, I mean, Wham, E17, all the boy bands, Mariah Carey, all the artists that I wouldn't normally listen to, as soon as they put a bit of sleigh bells on the production, I'm good with it.
Well, mm-hmm. You see, I like the word that you chose to describe it, cheesy.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And Christmas is a cheesy time.
It is. To celebrate, you don't have to think too deeply about mm-hmm. a lot of these things. You just have to take the joy that's inherent in the work.
It's the one time of year when you, the need to be cool, actually, you just get time off. Is that what it is?
I mean, I do tend to have like two Christmas playlists. The kind of more mainstream one, which is the one I play when my wife's in the house, and then the kind of more depressing one, which is maybe more the traditional stuff. Reinterpretations by people like Lowe or Sufjan Stevens, which is a bit more kind of down tempo, and it's very much towards that kind of traditional folk music style of Christmas songs. But I'm just as happy to listen to all of the shiny sleigh bell stuff, mm-hmm. Whether it's through from Phil Spector all the way up to Billy Idol has a fantastic Christmas album. I mean, it's absolutely appalling. It's terribly, terribly done, but it's
Do you guys remember the Ray Conniff singers?
Yeah, of course.
To me, they were the epitome of Christmas songs.
Yeah, of course. And that kind of easy listening lift mm-hmm. music kind of feel perfectly kind of complements.
And lots of people.
Lots of people. Yes, exactly. You know, a lot of choirs.
So it made it quite, group activity, make Christmas even more of a group activity.
I grew up in England, like you, Matt, and I grew up with Christmas songs. I don't dislike them, but I as soon as I hear any of them, it does bring back memories, but I'm not like terribly.
But how?
Not
how,
happy memories?
No, neither happy nor unhappy.
How can you not hear the intro to that, the Slade's Merry Christmas, everybody? And that's it's Christmas. And as soon as you hear that, exactly, Vernon laughed because as soon as you hear that, it just puts a smile on your face because it's so silly.
Two things drive me. One is, isn't there a kind of rather forced jollity about it? Because Christmas can be, for a lot of families, it's a miserable time of year. Well, most arguments, etc., happen then. And also, I can't get out of my head the fact that, yes, it's a Christmas song, but they recorded it back in August.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a great story about Slade as well, because they recorded it in New York in 1973. And, of course, they're from the Midlands in the UK. So everyone was wondering what this bunch of Brummies was doing shouting about Christmas in the streets in New York in the middle of August. So, yes, there is that kind of juxtaposition.
But that also brings us to the fact that it is the Christmas song is very much, I think, a British thing.
I think so, yeah. I mean, you do see...
The Christmas. Okay, yeah. As opposed
the
to
pop,
like the
Christmas
yeah,
pop
yeah,
song. Okay.
I think so. Although a lot of the R&B stars in the States do albums. So a lot of the classics are actually American. There's a Motown Christmas, which is fantastic. Mm. There's James Brown's Funky Christmas, which is another classic from the kind of late 60s and early 70s.
Oh. And then in the 90s, they started doing dirty Christmas songs. I don't know whether you guys remember this.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like adults only kind of Christmas songs.
Yes.
Really?
When Santa gets up to naughty things.
Yes.
You know, and stuff like that.
I remember Santa kissing Mother under the mistletoe.
Well, it went beyond that, believe me. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I've led a sheltered life.
You have. That's why you don't have good memories of Christmas.
Yeah.
You've missed out on all these
songs. Maybe I saw Santa do something that just shocked me.
And a lot of the really great Christmas songs, like Fairy Tale of New York by The Pogues and Kirsty MacColl, that's quite aggressive, and that has a kind of back and forth because it's an argument between a couple. A Christmas duel between the Hives and Cyndi Lauper, that's not suitable for broadcast at all because there's more swearing in it than there's Christmas cheer. But it's just showing those different sides of Christmas as well. And of course, you can bring a serious message across. You've got songs like Happy Christmas, War is Over.
Feed the World.
Even the Band-Aid song. Yeah, it's again, it's really cheesy.
It's but Christmas
you can,
time.
Yeah, but you can't you can't listen to it and not feel something because you just feel the happiness of all the people that were actually singing
on
the song.
So even when it's rubbishing the whole, you know, belief involved in Christmas, like the adults-only versions, we still get into it.
You know, exactly.
We still enjoy it.
Yeah.
It still kind of like triggers off certain things in our brain that brings us back to our childhood.
Well, none of us have mentioned the Christian type-ness. I mean, there is. I mean, the Christmas song is actually divorced from Christianity. Right?
Oh, isn't it? I know. I mean, I don't listen to a lot of the kind of more kind of traditional choral kind of stuff.
Cantatas.
Although, yes, exactly. Cantatas. But my dad was a huge fan, and I think that's one of the reasons I have this love of Christmas songs. So the only time he would go to church would be...
That's the only time I would go to church.
Yeah, for the carols on Christmas Eve. He'd go to Midnight Mass in Ely Cathedral, and he would listen, because they've got a fantastic church organ, and a great choir, and he would just listen to all of the carols. Yeah. That was one of the high points of his year.
And it's a communal thing. I mean, you know, Christmas, family.
Okay, but we must move on. But let me just ask you quickly then, each one of us, your favorite Christmas song, Matt?
It has to be Fairy Tale of New York, the Pogues and Kirsty MacColl.
Ben?
I'll Be Home for Christmas. I really like that.
Who's that?
God, which version?
Good God, yeah. So many versions. I can't remember the...
Sing it. I can't remember it.
Sarah Vaughan version?
I'll Be Home for Christmas.
Yeah.
Well, mine obviously is Little Drummer Boy, Bing Crosby, and David Bowie because
David Bowie.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, and the high point of that was Bing Crosby.
Yes. Anyway, so great song. We move on now to topic number two, which is the only un-Christmassy topic here: the future of Facebook, because Facebook, which has been around now for 14 years.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Only 14 years.
It feels like it's been my life forever.
I know. And now Facebook claims that they have 1 billion regular users, which, I don't know, that sounds a bit... Anyway, they have a lot.
Yep.
But yet again, they find themselves in hot water over data sharing accusations. And it seems to be a pretty regular occurrence now with Facebook. And they're future business prospects are looking a little bit bleak because the uptake of new users seems to be, well, pretty much flatlining. And so I want to ask you two, because you two know much more about these things than I do. Mm. What is the future of Facebook? Because it is so ubiquitous. It's such a constant in people's lives now of a certain age demographic. What is going to be in 10 or another 14 years' time?
I don't think it'll be here. Yeah. I think it'll be gone. I think it'll be the MySpace of this generation. We will all have these orphan profiles sitting on Facebook.
I kind of disagree with you.
Really?
Yeah, I think we've invested too much in it. We've invested too much of our lives in it. We've got too many baby photographs and wedding photographs and all in there.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I don't think it's necessarily going to come from the users. I just think from a commercial standpoint, I don't think the company will be able to sustain and to make money in the long term. And also, it's kind of behind trends in the way that technology is shifting. So we're looking at the kind of next jump in technology, which is kind of screenless technology. Ah. So a lot of things, you know, Siri and Google Home. So getting a lot of information delivered by voice. And I don't think Facebook is going to make that transition very easily into this kind of screenless era.
Matt, that doesn't answer the way you use Facebook, which is lots of photographs of your very beautiful but very aging cat.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, Siri, tell me about Matt's cat. It's not going to work.
Yeah, you haven't invested as much as I have invested.
Yeah.
I've got everything there. My Facebook account is my life's journal. More than half of what I put up there is not for public consumption.
It's a mind device for a lot of people, for sure. Yeah.
It's just your archive,
yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, it's my archive. Yeah? I put in a lot of stuff to remind me of stuff to... Yeah, everything I document, even shopping receipts. Nobody sees that, but it's there.
On Facebook?
Yeah. I use the album's privacy setting.
Uh-huh.
And nobody else sees it.
And you are deliberately using it as your personal archiving.
Right.
Yeah, as a diary.
And I think a lot of people do that.
You know? Oh, yeah, they do. But that doesn't necessarily make a lot of money for Facebook. So
that is true.
Yeah, so when you look at the user growth is kind of flatlining because the younger generation see it as the device of their parents and of the older generation. So that is also true. Yeah. So you're getting this kind of decaying lifespan as people will move off the platform.
But even as they grow, they seem to kind of like swallow up other apps and things online.
Yeah, so
to a point where they are kind of like growing, but not through the Facebook.
Oh, sure.
Brand.
Yeah, I mean, I think Facebook as the parent company will still be around. They will still have holdings in technology, but I'm not sure that the Facebook platform itself will actually find itself adaptable to the next couple of jumps.
So can I ask then? Facebook, that as we know it, has this been an age-specific demographic thing? So the likes of us who are not born into the internet, and the internet arrived in our lives when we were already pretty fully formed, but we've used the internet. It worked for us because we wanted a platform where we could kind of declaim things. We could say things out loud to persuade the world.
Well, I know that my nephews and nieces kind of like started to desert their Facebook accounts, especially once their parents came on.
I was going to ask, was it because their parents or just because it just served them no purpose in the way that they...
I think it was a combination of things. It was, okay, the older folks are getting on. We don't really want to share stuff with them. And also, I think the volume of, you know, stuff that they had to put up, there was this, you know, most of them switched off thinking, you know, I'm not going to do this every day or whatever. And Instagram or Twitter seem to, you know, serve the purpose. So in terms of SockMed, they kind of like, kind of changed over to other brands. But the whole idea of Facebook itself, by its very nature, I think as that personal, I don't know, enhancement kind of thing, I think will exist, but will evolve into something else that we may not be able to see.
So will Vernon be able to access his shopping receipts?
Oh, I hope I will.
I would imagine so. I mean, you can still access your MySpace profile.
Can I?
Yeah, it's still sitting there from 2003 or whatever.
Were you with the hairstyle. were you on MySpace in any big way? Because
not,
I wasn't.
No, not in any big way. I put up a couple of test profiles. Like I'd record random bits of looped music and just put it up as drones to see if anyone would actually listen to it. And
so the activity on MySpace was kind of different from the kind of activities. So it was more specialized. Whereas Facebook kind of like swallows up anything and everything that you want to execute in daily living.
But again, part of that is due to the fact that Facebook is constantly chasing what we want from it, which is one of the reasons they're so far now into trying to give us programmed content. They're trying to produce original TV content because of the threat of services like Netflix. So they hate the idea that we go outside of the service, but increasingly we do. And when you look at these...
But then they also make money from Netflix.
No, yes, of course they do. But when you talk about voice-activated services. Mm. Facebook doesn't have a part of that because as soon as you go to Google and start asking it for information, there's no way for Facebook to get into that discussion and that conversation. And they're very much behind the curve when it comes to this kind of AI programming. So you see them trying to push in this direction, but they're very much behind Amazon and Google and even Apple, which is not particularly advanced in this field.
Mm. So can I ask then? Obviously, a bit of culture pension fund has 100 million sitting there waiting to be invested into something.
Of course.
And so what would you suggest we invest in terms of I mean, if one had been on the ground floor at Facebook back in 14 years ago, we'd be incredibly rich. So what would be the next thing?
Oh, I think a lot of the next thing is going to be these kind of social behavior scoring apps that we're seeing coming out of places like China. Obviously, Instagram is still huge, which, of course, is part of the Facebook group.
And WhatsApp as
and, well. And WhatsApp, but also Line and a lot of the other private messaging apps.
Can I ask you, you mentioned, what was it? Something scoring?
Yeah, personal so behavior it's social scoring. Behavior scoring apps. Okay. Yes, so this is... this is where you earn kind of societal points. So if you help an old lady across the road,
right.
then your app gets...
That reward kind of
you
thing.
You get a reward for that. But China is also using it in a negative sense because you can be scored according to the people you're friends with. So if one of your friends is a dissident, you will be scored at a lower rate. You will lose score depending on who you know.
Well, that's a big brother for you.
Yeah, yeah. And those social scores are linked to access to government services. So if you don't have a score above a certain level, you can't travel, you can't get access to healthcare or government housing. So it is a kind of control tool, but I think we're going to see more of this.
Well,
not necessarily that we should.
I just came from Singapore, and apparently the government there invested in these Fitbit type watches, which is free to all its citizens who sign up. And apparently, if you do like 1,500 steps a day or something, you get a $5 voucher or something. Mm. So it's this whole thing about
absolutely
behavior, social behavior monitoring, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
It is interesting, but the kind of logical progression of that is to link that Fitbit to your insurance company. Mm. And your insurance company will say to you,
all
if you
data.
Ever take it off, you're no longer covered.
Oh, this is just... Matt, you always do this. You come here and then you terrify me.
I came here talking about Christmas.
I know, it's not Christmas.
This isn't my topic.
I was happy. We were all happy.
It was actually your fault, Cam. You brought it up.
Yeah.
Okay, look, we're going to move on, right? Before Matt brings us down too much. But in a moment, we're going to be happy again.
Good.
With Christmas pantomimes here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Matt Armitage, and Vernon Adrian Amon. And now, Vernon, topic number three, Christmas pantomimes.
Mm. Well, I just came back from Singapore after watching the Walrus Theatre Company's pantomime, Christmas pantomime, called A Singapore Carol. And it was a modified version of Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol.
Mm-hmm.
And Scrooge became S.K. Liu, an app developer in Singapore.
Wow.
You know, and it was you know, tailored to suit the Singaporean audience with a lot of gags about living in Singapore and, you know, very funny.
Before maybe we should clarify, not all listeners would be very familiar with what a pantomime, Christmas pantomime is.
Yeah.
Now, Matt and I, we both grew up in England, so we grew up in Panto Land.
Yes, in Panto Land, although not in Pantos.
So perhaps let me see if I can quickly define what Christmas Panto is. So every Christmas season, there are these shows that are put on, very much a variety show, and the storyline is broken up with song and dance.
Yes.
Very audience participation is aimed very much at children.
Yep.
And it's an exaggerated version of whatever story. So
it could be a fairy tale.
Could be Aladdin is a very popular one. Peter Pan.
Dick Whittington is another one.
Dick Whittington, very English thing again. In this case, Christmas Carol down in Singapore.
Yeah.
And so did you like it?
Well, when I first started watching it, I was thinking, are they trying too hard? Because, of course, I'm familiar with the Charles Dickens story. And here was a force-fitted version of a Singapore perspective on it. But I tell you, after interval, the second act took off, I was completely sold. I think by that time, I had gotten used to the whole idea that this was a Singapore story. Okay, and I really enjoyed it. I mean, it's colorful, it's extravagant, it's really, really funny, it's very topical, it's irreverent, it has kids in it, so, you know, parents are there going, ooh, ah, and they're cute and wonderful and talented kids. And in this particular version, there was no drag acts because usually in traditional pantomimes, the ugly sisters in Cinderella would be men in drag.
Yeah.
But this one, for some reason, didn't have it. I guess it, you know, wasn't necessary in the story. However, the three ghosts, they could have been men, but they were not. The three ghosts of Christmas present, Christmas past, and Christmas yet to be were three wonderful actors who, female actors who did a wonderful job.
Mm.
But it made me think about this whole idea that the Christmas pantomime, because it's for the whole family and during the Christmas period, and there's a lot of taking the Mickey out of things, mm-hmm. whether it actually helps to make people who celebrate Christmas a little bit more culturally resilient in that they are not so easily offended when their cultural practices or faiths are made fun of.
I think where you're coming from is very much a Malaysian perspective. I mean, in England, that
you don't think about it.
It's not something that comes. It's not a question.
No, it's not a question.
Because it's part of the dominant paradigm of the nation,
and it comes out of that kind of music hall tradition. And it's one of the only connections with that kind of folk theatre. As you were saying, you know, it is very topical. So you have a lot of levels of jokes within pantos. You have the obvious stuff that's for the kids. You have the double entendres, which is from the music hall. But you also have very often this kind of political or social layer, which kind of challenges what's happening what has been happening in society over the last 12 months.
Because it's a working class art form.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not for the high culture.
I mean, that's what I mean. It's kind of a combination of theatre and music hall. So it's very much out of that kind of working class expression.
It's one of the last bits of that old music hall tradition you can find. But I have to say that when I was very young, we left England. Sorry, we left Malaysia. We moved to England, and so my mother would take us to pantomime. And I was about 5 or 6 years old. We'd go off to London and we'd watch a Christmas panto. And I think
did you have fun? You didn't have fun with Christmas songs.
I think fresh off the boat from Malaysia, I found the whole thing so confusing. it's like, what is going on here? Mother, this is not Shakespeare. You said we were going to the theatre, I think I saw Lulu in
Peter the famous Pan. Lulu.
Yeah, the singer.
Morris Gibbs' wife.
Oh, were they?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. In Peter Pan, flying through the air, and I just confused the hell out of me. After living in England for many years, then I began to understand what it was all about, and I never watched it again. But I've been back since, and just when I was back recently, someone said to me, oh, we must go and watch a Christmas panto. So society has changed so much that this once working class art form, which nice middle class people such as myself sort of like, you know, turn their backs on, is now appropriate and accepted across the
is what middle class people do, isn't it? They appropriate all the
they hipsterize it. Wow. I mean Matt, were you did you see it as a working class?
For me, my experience was the other way around. I grew up in the countryside in rural Norfolk. So to me, theatre was panto. So you're saying you went to panto and you say it's not Shakespeare. We didn't have any Shakespeare. For us, theatre was panto. That was the one time in the year where you would go and see a theatre type production. It never really occurred to me whether it was a working class thing or a middle class thing. I mean, I think it was put on by the Amateur Dramatic Society, which tend to be quite middle class. But the audience would just be everybody in the town. So it was a very kind of inclusive thing. It wasn't a tiered thing. Yes, you might have sort of the more well-to-do folks who might go off to Norwich or Cambridge or even down to London to see some of the big celebrity ones. But for the rest of us, it was just panto in our village hall.
Vernon, you enjoyed doing the panto. Watching the panto. Would you put on a pantomime in Malaysia? And if you did, what pitfalls and hurdles would you have to...
Yeah, I would like to give it a go. Mm-hmm. I think the thing about it is that how to make it enjoyable and accessible by our very multicultural society.
Because in this country, it would have to somehow justify itself or cross some sort of barrier of its Christianness, because Christmas is a Christian thing in this country. But
it depends on the tale, doesn't it? I mean, if you're telling Arabian Nights or
Why would it be on at Christmas time? Why is it in August?
I think it's probably just because the working classes would actually have time off.
And also because, it's end of the year, you want to end with a bang.
But what I mean here, I can see why you say in England, but here, if you're going to put on, it's going to be very obviously straight away, it's a Christian
thing. It'll probably be branded as a year-end panto.
Yeah.
You know,
a year-end
kind of thing.
Okay,
yeah.
Fair enough. That makes sense.
Festive season panto rather than a Christmas panto.
Well, what festive season? Then it was like, what, Kwanzaa? What are you talking about? Hanukkah?
Winterville, so I think, seasons, is one of the...
Winterville. The okay, that's a nice one. All right. So you should do it. You should do them.
Yeah. But well, I think there's a nice thing about a lot of the kind of current pantomimes is that they're all, certainly in the UK, most of them are written by one guy. Or certainly
literally one person.
Yeah. Because a lot of the towns and whatever, they just take the scripts that have already been done and base the production around.
Well, reading the program. Yeah. I mean, apparently Wild Rice thought they just have a repertoire of three or four pantomimes that they rotate throughout the years, but they've ended up creating 15 books, 15 stories, and last year it was based on the Lady Whitesnake myth. So it was a Chinese fairy tale, which... Now, the thing is, this was the first Christmas pantomime from Wild Rice that I saw, which had quite a deep kind of like Christmas feeling to it because it was connected to a Christmas carol. Right? Previous years, they've done other fairy tales, which didn't have that kind of link, although it was sold. Now I'm trying to think whether they did actually sell it as a Christmas pantomime or as a year-end pantomime.
Because the pantomime, I think, For our Malaysian audience, it is the closest thing. It's exactly the same actually as Bangsa One.
Yeah.
It's the same thing, that variety show where there's
larger than life characters, morality tale happening,
and often Arabian Nights was a very popular vehicle for Bangsa One and for Panto. So you know, it's a Malaysian
possible
thing. But we move on now, and we're going to come to the final part of the show, recommendations, where we recommend something that we think might be of interest. My recommendation is, you know, people often stop me in the street and they ask me, Cam, I mean, is there a book that really talks about the grand strategy of the Habsburg Empire? I mean, Vernon, just the other day you were asking me. And I say, no, there isn't.
I have a pile of books about the Habsburg Empire that are literally propping open a door because I start them all and they just are not engaging enough.
Well, Matt, I think I may have found the answer
to you.
Thank you. They walk away unhappy because I have to say, no, there's no book on that. But finally there is. And I'm reading it at the moment. And it
Christmas time for you.
Yes, it's a Christmas classic already. It's called The Grand Strategy of the Habsburg Empire by A. Wes Mitchell. And it's just come out. I'm reading it at the moment. I'm absolutely enthralled. It's like one of the best books I've read in ages. And it just talks about the strategy of a state that it calls an interstitial state. An interstitial is one which is...
In the cracks.
Yeah, it's in between other empires, other states. And so how does it survive? What was its strategy over hundreds of years in order to survive in a very dangerous part of the world? And how it did manage to do it successfully and ultimately not successfully. So that's my recommendation, The Grand Strategy of the Habsburg Empire. Next recommendation is by Vernon.
Oh, my recommendation is, if I may bring up my Saraniness again, there's this book that won the award from the Singapore Library Board called Others Is Not a Race, and it's by Melissa De Silva. Okay, it won the award for non-fiction creative writing, and it's basically stories that Melissa put together that kind of like reflected on being Sarani Eurasian, about being mixed race. And hence the title, Others Is Not a Race, because in racial categorization in Singapore, as well as even in Malaysia, Sarani Eurasian, basically, you know, dropped into the Others box. And the thing about it is that because it's Christmas, the Sarani tradition is we have suji cake. Have you heard of suji cake?
Of course not.
It's a very legendary kind of like Christmas tradition here. And it originates from the Sarani community. And her book, one of the stories, is about making suji cake. So you can kill three birds with two stones by picking up the book, learning how to make suji cake, and finding out about the Sarani heritage.
Okay, and the name of the book again?
Others Is Not a Race.
By?
Melissa De Silva.
Okay, cool. And now, finally, we're going to have Matt Armitage's recommendation. What is it?
It is a Christmas song, of course.
You're going to sing one.
Sorry, am I going to sing? No, I'm not going to sing, thankfully.
Thank God.
This is by a British psychedelic band that have been around for the last few years called the White Horses. So they make some very varied music from kind of acid-fried folk all the way to very kind of dirgy and deep kind of modern psychedelia. Mm. They've released a very Phil Spector-ish sounding song called Next Year Will Be Mine. So it's full of sleigh bells and it's full of that kind of lovely kind of ch-ch-ch-ch kind of beat that all the best Christmas songs have. But at the same time, it was what we were talking about earlier. It's a very honest song. So it's when they say next year will be mine, they're talking about all of the things that they haven't been happy with in their year in 2018 and all the reasons why 2019 will be a better year for them.
But, full of hope.
Yeah, full of hope. But because of that ch-ch-ch-ch beat of sleigh bells, it sounds very jolly, even if the subject matter itself isn't the happiest. So that is my recommendation for this year. And I think we might even be able to hear the song. Next year will be mine by the White Horses.
Yeah, well, we will be playing out with that for sure. And I look forward to hearing it. It sounds really hip and groovy. Mm. It's my kind of thing. So that brings us to the end of this week's show. And only remains for me now to thank special guests Vernon Adrian Emong.
Thank you.
And Matt Armitage.
Thank you.
Myself, Cam Ruslan. And I don't know, like our Facebook page while it's still there.
Especially with that $100 million worth of investment still available.
Yes, yes. And I just want to tell you folks, that if you do like our Facebook page, I don't want you to be under any false impressions. Absolutely nothing will happen. That nothing happens there, but you're just going to press it because it's just a thing that you want to do. We finished the show and we're going to play out with Matt Armitage's Christmas song, which, tell us again what it is.
Next Year Will Be Mine by the White Horses.
Here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9.
Another 12 months, I throw myself fast. I've got to kill my fear, destroy.